You are listening to the podcast of the Matyas Corvinus Collegium, the largest talent management institute in Hungary. If you want to know more about our mission, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter channels. For interesting articles and analysis of our professors, external contributors, and students, look up our knowledge base at corvinec.hu/en.
Hello, this is Peter Hatai, host of the MCC podcast, and I will be talking today with a very special guest, Gladen Papin, who is assistant professor of politics at the University of Dallas and co-founder and deputy editor of the American Affairs Journal, and who, in spite of the difficult circumstances, was brave enough to fly over to Budapest and visit us for a few days. We are very keen, therefore, to use this opportunity to learn more about his work and ask his opinion about the US, Europe, Hungary and Poland, the state of our Western civilization, and popular terms like post-liberal and post-Christian. Professor Papin, welcome to Hungary and MCC Podcast.
It's great to be here.
And well, it's not a secret that you're here in Budapest for a few days as our guest, as a guest of MCC, of Matyas Corvinus Collegium. My first question would be just to start off, how do you fear yourself in this, well, using the words of President-elect Biden, totalitarian country?
Well, it seems like a very nice place to me, and I have been interested in following developments of conservatism in Europe for 15 years, and seriously in terms of visiting and talking to European conservatives for the last 10 years. And I think that American conservatives and European conservatives have a lot to learn from one another, and in many cases face the same political situation. Actually, what I think then candidate Biden was suggesting was that he was opposed to Trump and saw some alignment with the Trump agenda or a sort of nationalist populist line emerging elsewhere. So I expect that to come back up in his administration. And in the meantime, before those days begin, I wanted to take advantage of the very kind invitation, and it's great to be here.
The reason I ask you, because you wrote recently an op-ed for Newsweek, I think in October before the elections, but after Biden's speech defending Poland and Hungary from the accusations that he has made, and you claim that these countries are in the crosshairs because they stand for traditional values and have, well, sort of a nationalistic policy, or they try to introduce policies from a more nationalistic or traditional conservative perspective here in Europe. But still, why do you think that Biden or his speech writers highlighted these Central European countries? Because, you know, from an American perspective, we are like, you know, small countries in Europe, not even the leaders of the EU. We are only member states. Why did they highlight these countries?
The answer, I think, is that the liberal or global neoliberal consensus is actually very fragile. And I think that the 2020 election campaign, of which that intervention was a part, indicated this. When one has a strong political position, one can state it forwardly and argue for it and explain it and try to convince people of it. Certainly the presence of the personality of Donald Trump made it easy for the left in the United States to focus on that personality. But in a broader sense, they seem to have nothing else other than attacking him. They were really focused on attacking Trump throughout 2020. And all the institutions of liberalism, of which big tech has become a part or even an agent force, clamped down on expressions of conservative speech, excluding those voices from the mainstream media, making it more difficult to find conservative voices in Facebook and Twitter, as we've all seen. So I think all of those are signs that liberalism or neoliberalism feels that there's something fragile about its consensus, that maybe it's not a consensus or that it could be easily threatened. And I think that's the perspective from which Hungary and Poland, being strong witnesses of a proud tradition of their nation states, but which are governing in the national interest. If if global neoliberalism were stronger, would it feel it necessary to, so to speak, go after the little guy? Probably not. I think the fact that there's a clear democratic mandate for the governments in Hungary and Poland, they're democratic regimes, makes it hard for liberals and neoliberals to argue against them. Trump was often criticized for making foreign policy gaffes, you know, for not understanding the delicate rhetoric necessary in international relations when dealing with our allies. And that's really what prompted me to write that op-ed, was seeing, this consensus must actually be fragile if this is the way that it's running its election campaign, so to speak. And in the second respect, if Trump had said something similar about, or any time he actually did sort of slip rhetorically and exaggerate in referring to other countries, he was immediately hounded. Poland and Hungary are allies of the United States, member states in good standing of the European Union, and to mention them, he didn't mention them explicitly as totalitarian states, but in the sentence, kind of alongside and grouped with them as they appeared in his mind as a problem. It showed, I think, I don't think he'd thought through the line very clearly, and it showed that the reflex position was to attack even now the smallest attempt to crack the neoliberal consensus. So I think it shows it's fragile.
Totalitarian or totalitarianism is something, has a very special meaning, and it for us, and it tears open old wounds, really, because we are nations who have been suffered from real totalitarian regimes, the Nazis, the communists. So this reflected or echoed here in this region, especially harsh, so to say. So at least it was quite a punchy start. Do you believe that the future administration will pay a special attention to the region or to the EU in general, so to say, ideologically?
Yes, but if I could echo what you were saying at the beginning of your question there, but before getting to it, I think this is a problem of the current state of liberal discourse, is that it's cheapening terms which do have a real meaning, including racism. I mean, racism is real. There's no reason to pretend that it's not, or that it's not part of American history. I mean, it certainly is. But you see that term being expanded to cover every kind of. It's become kind of a catch-all term of art for political deviation, I guess. So I think you see that echoed in the way that totalitarian is now thrown around. And in that case, in a really ignorant way, against countries that actually know what actual totalitarianism really is. I'll take just a moment to plug my own university of Dallas. The initial faculty of the University of Dallas, most of them were Cistercians, Cistercian monks who had fled from Hungary around 1950 or the end of the 1940s, I think first to Rome, and then were invited by the Bishop of Dallas to start an abbey in Dallas. Then after 1956, they stayed in Dallas. So, the original...
And the community still exists.
That community still exists, the Abbey of Our Lady of Dallas. It's actually a flourishing monastic community of very orthodox and faithful monks who older and younger, still teach at the University of Dallas, which has always had a particular connection to European issues. So I didn't mean to jump over your question, but I wanted to mention that. So if you want me to come back then on the substance of the question, yeah, I think in the simplest way, the rhetoric after over the last month in, say, the mainstream media in the United States has been, now order is restored. The disruptive 4 years are over. Now the rain is over and gone. The nation is healing.
The great reset.
The great reset, something else, it seems, and even beyond that. But you can see this in some of Biden's initial indicated appointments. I think if the nomination of Antony Blinken goes through as Secretary of State, that's, I think, someone who probably unfortunately for the government of Hungary has a personal or familial stake in the in a Western European so-called liberal consensus. The only thing I think is that during the 4 years of Trump, the defenders of that liberal consensus focused so much on him that they may not be aware of their fragile position. It seems that they are, given that they pulled out all the stops, the media, tech industry, to make sure that Trump would lose, maybe even a few little extra stops pearl out beyond that, who knows. But they may not actually be fully aware of the fragility of their position, even though they are kind of lashing out as though they are. So I think the question will be, does the Biden administration, enter into power smug and kind of like the third term of the Obama administration, but with more of the institutions of the United States and the West behind it, from academia to the media, or has it learned anything? And I suspect that it hasn't.
You've already mentioned several times the term liberal. So I would like to shift our conversation to a little more theoretical, towards a little more theoretical topics, because I think it's very important, and I'm very curious of your opinion, to talk about, to frequently use terms in the international, Western, at least Western political discussions, fights or debates. And I know that these terms or phrases have many layers, but nevertheless are crucial. And the first one would be post-liberal. Do you think we live, or are we approaching, a post-liberal era? Yes or no, and why?
It's a really great question, and as you suggest, finding the right terms to describe political situations is a difficult one, and one that I think theorists are continuing to explore right now. So I'll get back to answering that, but the framework that I would suggest for thinking about that is what is a sufficient justification of our political institutions now? You know, what is the nature of our social contract, so to speak? And that, of course, may be different in the United States and some of the traditional nation states of Europe. So the debate about liberalism is often framed as between proponents of the existing liberal consensus. What is the liberal consensus? It's an explanation for the legitimacy of power, originally on the basis of consent, and orienting the state toward a very limited concern with economic goods and property and equality. And so from that standpoint, post-liberal thinkers we'll get to in just a second trying to capture what that might mean. But when the framework of the discussion is, are you in favor of against a liberalism? Are you in favor of or against freedom? How could you be against freedom? Post-liberal, does that mean you're post-freedom, means you're not in favor of freedom? When that's the terms of the discourse, it's very hard to think clearly about it. The question really for me is, is liberalism a sufficient justification for current policies? Does it cause people to feel that they have a stake in their community, or does it not? I'm in the camp that thinks that it's not sufficient. Some thinkers, actually left-wing thinkers like Giorgio Agamben in Italy and others, have referred to the current period as a kind of interregnum, where the ideologies which justified power in the 19th and most of the 20th century actually don't work anymore. They're kind of, actually even the postmodernists held this view that the major justifications weren't really working anymore.
Do you think that are we near to see or to discover these new words that we'll be able to describe, well, not only our current political world, but our lives or existence in the 21st century?
Of course, I think we should discover true explanations before words, which merely point to reality, other realities, at least if we're not nominalists. I think one question would be, you know, why has the word conservatism not, why is that not a sufficient word at the moment? Of course, I'm a conservative. I think it's an important part of our worldview. In the Anglo-American world, 20, 30 years ago, people at conservative conferences said very clearly, well, conservatism in the Anglosphere means liberalism. So that's one reason that conservatism has worn down a little bit. And the second reason, as Michael Anton said under a pseudonym in a famous article of autumn of 2016, conservatives conserved nothing. And that was, I think, what the Trump campaign, put forward for a lot of people. So finding the right language is important. I think post-liberalism is just a kind of initial thumbnail sketch for a set of other explanatory frameworks and policies. So I would be happy using sovereigntist. It's not really a word in English, whereas it is in French, say souverainiste, something like that.
That's something that we use, or at least on a political level here in Europe. So when politicians, especially in Central Europe, for instance, they are in favor of sovereign nation states, they're in favor of sovereign governments, sovereign decisions. This is something that exists, maybe in another context, but at least they're using here in Europe as well.
There could be a little fracture among some groups of post-liberals more broadly. I think some post-liberals have begun to use the term post-liberalism in order to critique all modern forms of sovereignty, whereas for me, it's very important to remain practical and see what the current levers of power are. Nation-states are real political phenomena, particularly in Europe. I think Pierre Manon in France has been the most insightful illuminator of the fact that a nation state remains both a politically viable project and a real cultural reference point. Maybe even in a way that it's America may be even a little bit different from that. I've also advanced and explored this word integralist, which has kind of sounds like a mathematical equation, so it's maybe not the most compelling political term sometimes. But I think the thought behind it is that society, economy, and the state have fallen out of coordination. The economy, as one postmodern theorist once said, has gone into orbit. I know it's something that occurs now outside of national frameworks. You talk about the common good in some economic policy contexts, and it's viewed as something kind of quaint. Well, if the common good is viewed as quaint, maybe the problem is with the people who find that notion quaint. Maybe they're not putting enough effort into questions of how to link economy and the common good. So reintegrate, again, kind of too maybe too mathematical of a term, and we're pushing for terms. Adrian Vermeul has talked about common good constitutionalism, you know, a way of viewing constitutional law, public law more generally, as needing to be oriented toward the common good of a specific polity. I think all of those are viable frameworks for illuminating different aspects of the current political situation.
We have already touched upon this topic, how the term liberal became sort of empty, or it's frequently used, but we don't really know. Now, what do we mean by liberalism in general? I think that's the central problem right now, not only the United States, but Europe as well.
Let me say one thing about liberalism and America or the United States, and then one thing about liberalism as a political agenda or aggressive political force in the sense that you define it. First of all, although I did say that conservatism in the American context has been sort of reduced to liberalism, that really wasn't always the case. There are important strains of the British conservative, true conservative tradition early in the founding, and liberalism really came on the scene as a conscious ideology, you know, around and in the wake of World War II, and the injection of more libertarian thought into the American conservative tradition in reaction to FDR and the New Deal. So the conservatives who opposed the New Deal adopted this anti-statist framework, and then they kind of read that back into the American founding. If you actually go back to the American founding, say in the question of national economic policy, you did have a sort of libertarian strain, or really an agriculturalist strain, which was identified with Thomas Jefferson. Alexander Hamilton, though, was something more like a national conservative, as some people have called that strain or ideology or approach now. He favored protectionist measures to build up young industries in the United States, and he wanted the United States from the beginning. This comes from his report on manufacturers in 1791, which became a kind of blueprint for this approach. He wanted America to become an industrial powerhouse. So his view of federal power was far, far more statist than what we would now call, liberal conservative tradition. So to the second point, so that's a little bit to complicate the American heritage there. So American Affairs, which Julius Krein and I founded and co-founded a few years ago, has been trying to bring back that Hamiltonian tradition in economic policy. I think the reason that liberalism has become more aggressive, or that it's even become illiberal, is that, if Aristotle is right, politics is always about forming a particular way of life. And the liberal way of life is a thing. It's not simply a neutral description of an original political position in which everyone can freely make choices. It's an ideal which, as Tocqueville observed, in America especially, became more and more devoted to radical equality than to freedom itself. So Tocqueville observes that Americans are more devoted to equality than freedom, and that has become a kind of crusading way of life for liberals to spread this, way of life of equality, and that's led to a lot of ironies and things like that. If we just focus on the supposed hypocrisy of this, then we miss the fact that really the only sort of true liberals left are these center-right conservatives. They're, super interested in being authentically liberal, and I think the politics has passed them by, and the real conflict now is between a liberal ideology which wants to use power in order to create liberals, to create religion in its own image, to create economy in its own image, maybe through the Great Reset, as people are saying. And the only thing that can counteract that is a robust conservatism of the common good, or an integralism, a national approach to the common good that's willing to use political power.
We mainly ruined the second term, or the surprise at least of this podcast, because we have already talked about a little post-Christian, the post-Christian era, or that is it even possible to live in a post-Christian era? We have touched upon it a little, but I would like to ask you now a little bit more concretely about it, because I recall the words of Pope Benedict XVI, who is not only Pope Emeritus of the Catholic Church, but I think one of the greatest political and social thinkers of the 20th century, and one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century and the 21st century as well, when he said that Christians shall unite and act as a creative minority in this age, not necessarily leaving behind the Constantinian model, but somehow to rethink their strategies, how they can in a very positive way promote their values in society, that basically once created, that's my part already, the Western civilization. But I don't think that Ratzinger would disagree with that. Is that even a correct term for a Christian to declare an age post-Christian? I mean, doesn't it contradict to, you know, the concept of Christian hope?
Well, Pope Benedict XVI had a very interesting encyclical on the topic of hope, Spe Salvi, and I think that might be one place to explore your question, at least for listeners who want to read a bit more about the topic. He discusses in particularly at the beginning of Spe Salvi how the Christian concept of hope was essentially perverted by the early modern philosophers, Francis Bacon in particular, into a realization of transcendent hopes in the transformation of the world through science and technology. So, you know, to the extent that I would discuss a post-Christian civilization, I think it's one which has taken concepts that are integral to Christianity and reinvented them in a perverse manner, particularly through science and technology. Science and technology are not themselves bad, but this vision of technology as, for Francis Bacon in particular, his notion was we need to restore the powers that were taken from us by God as punishment for our sin. So it was really like a reversal of the Garden of Eden. Let's get back to the larger question. As you were talking about Pope Benedict XVI's views, I was reminded that among the many actually things that Pope Benedict XVI and Pope Francis share is an interest in these novels of Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson from the beginning of the 20th century. These were two novels. Well, he wrote many more, but these were Lord of the World and Dawn of All. Robert Hugh Benson was the son of the Archbishop of Canterbury, so he was a convert to Catholicism, you know, from being son of the head of the, at least the ecclesiastical head of the Church of England. And one of these novels, Lord of the World, was an apocalyptic novel, which, you know, not to spoil it, but it's the bad possible future, the future in which Christians continue to suffer as the Antichrist, you know, rises up and takes over the world. People complained that this novel was too negative, so he wrote a positive vision, which was called Dawn of All. Anyway, both Benedict XVI and Pope Francis have recommended reading Lord of the World, which gives an indication of something that they're thinking about.
As I'm hearing this story, this reminds me of the Book of Apocalypse. So it's not like maybe the novel can be, you know, not too positive, but it certainly, you know, reflects on an actual book of the Bible when it comes to, you know, the suffering of Christians and the rise of the Antichrist in the last times of humanity.
What interests me more is this book, Dawn of All. Dawn of All envisions the opposite future. A Monsignor falls, you know, wakes up one day. He's not sure where he is or what has happened in the intervening years, but he realizes that very strange things have happened and that the world has converted and is in the process of becoming Christian again through political leaders, actually. And as he explores, you know, talking to those around him, you know, what led to this change, people observe, well, you know, for example, it turns out that people realized that Christianity gave a better explanation of the soul than psychology did, and many other things like that. So reading Dawn of All, which I highly recommend, I think should be used to give Christians a more strategic view of possibility. In a way, we have to prepare for both outcomes. I like to talk about there being, you know, four possible futures of the Catholic Church and other churches in the United States, one that they kind of continue to muddle along as they are, two, that they become kind of radically identified with, you know, the right or the Trumpist movement in the United States, which seems to be a new phenomenon. And then the third and fourth scenarios, the Lord of the World and the Dawn of All. If we assume that the Lord of the World scenario is the future, then we might not be attuned to the possibilities of rebuilding Christianity and Christian civilization sometimes even rapidly out of the ruins.
And this leads us to, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but this definitely leads us, these thoughts to the future, and not only the future of Christians in the Western society or in the world in general, but also to the future of Western thought and of this term that we have already mentioned, post-liberal and post-Christian. I would like to close by asking you about your opinion about this competition, which is going on mainly around words, I think. So what do you think? Is it going to be an age of identity or community, globalism or localism, nation states or world organizations, digital innovation or personal connections?
Are those pairs or what?
These are just my picks.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge to navigate through those. So I think that as you were asking your question before the barrage of terms at the end, I was beginning to think about the relationship of Christianity and political organization, and we can hardly say that the future will definitively be one of any sort of restored connection between Christianity and political organization, but. Christians have always viewed themselves as a group. Just think about Augustine's City of God. That was written, this was a City of God against the pagans, or concerning the City of God against the pagans. That was written after the sack of Rome, certainly at a time when things seemed pretty dark for civilization and law, and dark for Christianity as well. Yet it was in the centuries after that, alongside it, Roman law was systematized and preserved and eventually in the early Middle Ages transmitted to the future, kept and preserved. And it was right at that time through Augustine's work, really, that Christians clearly saw that they were a special kind of community, certain kind of community, not just individual believers exercising their rights to worship as might have been the approach in the 17th and 18th century, but a real community. So as things become worse in a lot of countries, certainly. Not here, where things have been many signs of hope, I think. But as things get worse in some countries, Christians have, I think, the risk of viewing themselves just as citizens of heaven, or just as citizens of the heavenly city, thinking just about eternity. But they are a group that has a real connection to one another.
Thank you for listening to this MCC podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, and students, check out our knowledge base at corvinec.hu/en.
In a way, I think that the further and further advance of these liberal and technological trends that you identified in your terms, the advance of non-Christian forms of identity politics, the separation of our nation states, many of them, not all of them, from the common good and their devotion to a kind of technocratic oligarchy, all of those things, they could, of course, drive Christians to despair, but instead they should drive Christians to recognize that they are part of a real community. So I think there's actually a lot of exciting work to be done in the recovery of that concept, as we realize that just freedom is not enough, that we need to recover Christian conceptions of law, right, and the church itself. So at what time those concepts will play their role, who knows? Some people have made the observation before that history is more about location than time. So even while things may be getting worse in certain Western European countries, it's good to see signs of hope here.
Wow, well, there is still a lot to talk about, but our time is up, unfortunately. Mr. Pepin, it's been a pleasure talking to you here on MCC Podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to this MCC Podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, students, check out our knowledge base at corvinec.hu/en.